Melvin Kenneth Williams, Clinkett named Juno Tlachait. Translated, it means lucky dream. My dad's name, Kauksaga. My mom's name, Skandaat, from Huna. I was drafted. When I got the notice, it was in December. And it says, season's greetings. You're hereby ordered to report for enlistment into the military. And but the date was in January. The date was in January. And the day we showed up, they said, well, you're ready to take the oath and become a military army, join that. I said, wait a minute, I can't do that. I got things back home I need to take care of. I mean, you don't pick up and leave. I got to put away my boat. I got to secure my house. And so then they delayed it for 1 month to come back in February. In February, me and Tony went up there together, cold up in Anchorage. We stayed in Anchorage for about 3 days, and then we got shipped to Fort Ord, California. They flew us down to Frisco, then they bust us into Fort Ord. Lots of activity there. Like 10,000 all in training all at the same time, a lot of men. That's about all that I remember about the first time, when I first initially moved in. So it was relatively easy for me, because coming from a small village, we always worked hard on where I was in physically good shape. There was guys there in the military that were overweight or just physically not capable. It was kind of boring because the leaders, the drill instructors, have to tune themselves into these guys, and you have to move as fast as they do. Pretty boring. You get people from college that go into our military, people that come from the street that don't have an education. So then talking to at a real low level, which it makes it very long in the classroom. Very long and very boring and tiring, and to keep it warm. The thing that I remember the most, moving on from Huna to like being in the military, I never knew prejudice until I went in the military. And all of a sudden I was writing, it was everywhere. It was everywhere. I couldn't understand a simple thing like going getting in line for the mess hall was chaotic. You don't just go in there and get in back of the line. You have to look for this bunch over here and this bunch over here. If you fit in that bunch or that bunch, you could join them. But from Alaska, I didn't fit anywhere. I mean, if I went there in there with the white, they'd be mad. Then the blacks would be mad because I was once them. You just wait for a good opportunity to sneak along somewhere. It is hard. I didn't know prejudice, and I really didn't know how to deal with that. That is probably the toughest thing I ever had to get accustomed to. Here, people come in and people go, and we didn't notice that here was a white man, here was a black man, or another native. People come and go, and just every day, you know. You don't pay attention to that kind of stuff. And when I went in the military, wow, I couldn't understand that. You know, we're all American. It was difficult. But I remember one instructor saying, asking me if I was, are you a rebel? I said, no, sir. He said, are you a Yankee? I said, no, sir. He said, who are you? I'm from Alaska, man. Leave me alone. You move into a whole different world. Not in the way I should have. I'll tell you a story. When I was stationed in Fort Campbell, because I was in charge of the communication team, they came to the motor pool. The sergeant came to the motor pool and said, Williams, he has to go to the colonel's office. What? I was on the, right out of the blue, I'm going there. So I had to run to the barracks, get out of my fatigues, get in my dress greens, and go about a mile away and report to the colonel. So I'm standing out there and waiting, standing at attention, and he's got a glass door, and he's waiting, and he knows I'm there. But about a half an hour, he finally called me on. Says, Private Williams reporting as order, sir. And he said, why don't you ever ride home? I said, pardon? Your family's wondering where you're at, and they want to hear from you. My mother went through all the trouble to go through the Department of the Army and finally traced me to Fort Campbell, and I had to go see the colonel. Only my mother could do that. I had to promise the colonel I was going to write a letter that night. I was telling a story earlier about my mom. We had to go before the colonel's office, up to the colonel's office, and When he finally called me into his room, he looked up and he said, "You're William." I said, "Yes, sir." "But you're an Indian." "Yes, sir." "How'd an Indian get a name like William?" I told him my dad had it. I was thinking that maybe he might have thought that I needed a name like a Sitting Bull or something like that. But that's the way we got away from our traditional Tlingit names. My name is Juno Tlachet. During the war, the German war, some military men were sent over here to Hoonah, and everybody lined up to be drafted. And a sergeant is looking at him and saying, "What's your name?" And I say, "Spayun," and he can't spell it. "What's your name?" "Son Jin." He can't spell that. He said, "Okay, that's it. That's it. From here on, you're going to have a new name." So all these guys standing in line, he looks up at him and he says, "Your name will be Harry Marvin. Here's your serial number. Here's your name. Here's how you spell it. Harry Marvin." Next, he says, "Your name will be Daniel Charclain. Here's how you spell it. Here's your serial number." Next, Harry and Daniel. Same mother, same father, different name. Any injustice in this world?
No.
Because of one man. Things change. How do you spell Junior Sussex? In the English world, things must have been really tough. A lot tougher than when I went in. Some of the men that were drafted years ago couldn't hardly even speak English. It must have been really tough for them. The food was, for the most part, nutritious, but it was pretty much tasteless. The thing about the training and the food was the skinny guys got heavier and heavy guys got lighter. It was tough training, but tougher training was in jump school. And remember I mentioned Tony. When we got into Fort Ord, California, Tony went to one barracks and I went to another barracks and we went through our training. And he was going to be a military occupation. He was going to be a truck driver. And I was going to be in communication. So we went to different schools. But Tony looked around and looked around and looked around until he finally found me. He's in the barracks way down on the other side. I'm in the barracks way up. He said, "I found the theater." He said, "There's a good movie on tonight." I said, "Well, we should go then." So he went back to him. I told him we'll meet down there. So we're walking. And this is on a Sunday. And while we're walking toward the theater, I said, "Wow, look at that. On a Sunday. Those people, they're training on a Sunday." And Tony just smiled and he says, "Come here." So I followed him. Sergeant had a clipboard to sign your name. He reaches in the box and gives you a number. Tony signed his name and he got a number. He's putting his number on, so I put mine on. And we run a mile and we do push-ups, whatever they say. We're doing all this stuff. They're grading us and stuff. About a week later, I follow for reveille early in the morning. And the master sergeant yells out, he's a bunch of names. And he said, "My name." He said, "You guys will be reporting to Fort Benning, Georgia, immediately after your MOS training." I said, "Doggone, Tony." He tricked me into becoming a paratrooper. But we were there almost, he was there before me. But we saw each other in Benning. And he got hurt on a 250-foot tower. He landed on a rock or something, broke his ankle. So they sent Tony to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, to Manton. He was supposed to go back to jump school training, but before that happened, his unit was sent over to Nam. So that's how Tony got to Vietnam. I finished jump school training and went to Campbell. So you make a few friends in there, and we'll get to plan things, like not too much you can do when you're in the military. It's only $150 a month. So it's not like you can go to the mall or anything like that. We go to a theater or a movie or do something that doesn't cost a lot of money because you didn't have a lot of money. Or just stay on the barracks and play basketball or football or whatever. After you finish basic training, you're given like, I think, a week or 2 weeks, something like that, to go home before your MOS starts. Well, on $100, $150 a month, and after basic training, I couldn't afford to go anyplace. But I made friends with this guy, and he says, "What are you doing?" "So I'm going to stay here, I guess. Got no money to go anywhere." He said, well, if you can buy a bus ticket, he said, you can go up to my house. His dad owned a ranch up in Northern California. Oh, yeah. So I bought a bus ticket and we went up there together. And it was a lot of fun because it was in a lake. There was a boat. Yeah, I could get in the boat and run around. I had a lot of fun. And went to a rodeo while I was there. That was fun. And they put a whole pig in the ground, like a Hawaiian luau. And maybe half a steer, half of them. That was a good feed. Before you finish basic training, they ask you, what are you interested in? Well, I thought, I'll let the military train me. I want to be an electrician. The only electrical thing that they had in the Army was communication. That's how I got into communication. Didn't do much good. When we're out of maneuvers, you run telephone lines here and telephone lines to all the different places. And I was on switchboard duty at night. So I get on at 9 o'clock. I'm supposed to get off at about 4 or 5 o'clock. About 2 o'clock in the morning, the switchboard sounded off. So I grabbed the thing and I plugged it in, and I plugged it into the wrong one. And then when I finally plug it into the right one, I supposed to ring until the light comes on or something. And I rang back into the colonel's ear. He said, whoa! Of course, he's mad at 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm nervous. They accuse you of all kinds of stuff. Sleeping on it. You don't fall asleep when you're on night call like that. It's just a military thing. But I didn't fall asleep. I just got all 2 o'clock in the morning. Kind of groggy, Being in communications, you run field wire everywhere. And the captain told me to run this wire from his tent up to this cradle. Two mountains. There's a big cradle in the middle. He said, run this up there. He said, there's a guy up there waiting for you. And it is our demonstration of a napalm, what to expect when you have a napalm explosion. So anyway, I get to the top, and it's easy to find a guy. He's sitting in a ditch. And in the ditch with him was like 5 or 6 50-gallon drums of napalm. He was sitting right on top of it. And he's got the wire in his hand, and he's touching them back and forth like this to see if he has a spark while he's sitting on the napalm. So I told him, here's the wire, here's the end of the wire, right here, I'm gone. Go back down the hill in a hurry. We were about a mile and a half away, and when that explosion went off, you feel the heat from it. A loud kaboom, and another while later, you feel the heat from it. That's dangerous stuff. When you live in the barracks, there are five billets in each barracks, 50 men in each billet, 250 men, but they're all new billets, new barracks, all concrete and modern. Had a good kitchen, big kitchen, dining room, had a day room, like in the old days when they had a wood frame structure. I was in Louisiana. When we got off from training, we went back in our barracks, and the floor is full of sand. The wind is blowing hard, and it blew the sand right through the cracks in the wall and spread it all over the floor, on our bed and everything. That's tough duty. When I went to Fort Benning, we got in there at night on the bus. So it's a little confusion. Nobody knows you never know what to expect. Because we got there at night, they gave us temporary quarters and what they call a holding area. So you're sleeping on cots. So the next day, the guy's in charge, he says, well, you're going to go here, you're going to go there, and everybody kind of splits up. So I get to my barracks, and it's supposed to be 250 guys. The place is empty. I have nobody around. So dinner, I go to the mess hall, and I eat, go back to my room, and nobody's showing up. Come find out, when you make a jump, usually the Naval Reserve pilots or Army Reserve pilots, they need to get their hours in. You get in a plane and they fly, they're getting their hours and flying everywhere before they fly over the drop zone and let you jump. So they're gone for like six, seven hours. I was sleeping when they finally come back into the barracks. And I said, I got some new guys here, new guys. These are 50 of them, 49 of them. And one of them goes outside and he catches a frog, a big bullfrog. And when you shoot flares up in the sky, they come down on a parachute. Well, they save that parachute, and they tie this frog to that thing and throw it out the window, and the frog would go down to the ground and hop away. And they go back down and get it. this road out again. I said, this frog got more jump than you do. You know, you don't say anything because there's so many of them. But the harassment never stops when you first get to the barracks. Everything you do is wrong. And after you get in there, you kind of fit in. You kind of fit in because there's people there from Guam, people there from Philippines, and just blend in with the crowd. I don't know if you learn stuff along the way or if it just happens that way, but somehow or another it kind of lightens up. Yeah, February 26th. The thing about when you're in the military, you have to get this packet. And I went down to the first sergeant's office and he gave me this packet. You got to clear the base. You got to clear the library. You got to clear the commissary. You got to clear everything. So they give you 90 days to clear. And once you get their signature on all these pages, then you can get, you're not really discharged. You're separated, what they call a separation. It's, you're actually a GI for like 8 years or something like that. See, I went in 60. I wasn't a civilian until 1970. So I went in 6 years. And if a conflict broke out anywhere, you're called back in. And that's the thing about being a paratrooper. When you're in a strike outfit like that, you're like the first group to go. Everybody said, well, the Marines are always the first one to go. No, I was sure. Paratroopers are the first one to go. And if a conflict, we're always on what they call immediate ready for it. It could be a 1 hour, could be 30 minutes, could be 10 minutes. As soon as a conflict broke out somewhere and the president ordered his troops to go over there, you got 1 hour or 10 minutes to get on the plane and you're flying out. There's a couple of times when on a 10-minute call, you sleep on the runway right next to the plane. 60 troopers on each plane. Some of the bigger planes are 120. I forgot what number that was, man. There's a lot of men. Look from one end to the runway to the other, and there's all these sleeping bags with people in them. There's a lot of fighting power there. I came home from Nashville. I had to fly to Chicago, then to Seattle, and then to Juneau. But while I was in Juneau, I had all my muster out pay. I went to a boatyard in Juneau called Warner's Marine, and I was looking at all the different boats and accessories that they need and everything, and nobody paid attention to me. People behind the deck. Finally, a guy comes and he said, have you been helped? No, but I want that boat right there with that motor and that motor on it. And I want this gas tank, extra gas tank, and a battery and all of that. And he said, how are you going to pay for that? So I went to his phone and called him. Bank. I told her I'm making a sizable purchase and I want to tell this guy if I'm good for it or not. I gave a phone to him. He said, you're good for it. But at that time, I bought a 16-foot Bolo Deluxe. That's a Pacific Mariner boat. A 95-horse Johnson with a 10-horse Johnson. All the batteries, fire extinguishers, everything you needed for the Coast Guard. When they put it in the water, took it out for a test run, I went back in his office to pay for it. $2,800. I helped my nephew buy a trolling motor for his boat, and it was $3,300. Just a small kicker motor. But I paid $2,800 for that boat. This is in February, March. I went fishing with my dad. He had a sand boat. And then in the fall, I got to figure out what I'm going to do with my life. So I'm toying with the idea of going to Anchorage to look for work. And they said, we can't hire you. You got to go to school. I said, I'm sick of school. I want work. I need work. But then the union school, when you go to school for 1 month, 4 weeks, and then you're able to get out on the job, if you're lucky. There was no job at that time, back in 66, 67. I didn't have oil yet. But if you're lucky, you get a job. Well, I gave the boat to my dad. He was carving, and when I decided that morning, I said, well, I got to make my move. So I went where my dad's carving in the back. Here, Dad. He looked up at me and put his hand up, dropped the keys in his hand. And so, what's this for, son? I'm going to go to Anchorage, go to work. But I'm giving you my boat. He said, but I got a boat. Now I got two. And that is a smart move on my part, because later that year, I think in September, October, he came to Anchorage and stayed with me in my apartment. And he had a box. He built this box. Screws all over it, and he gave me a screwdriver and take all the screws. He lifted the lid, and there was a sculpture of a Thunderbird. He said, "You gave me a present, son?" He said, "I'll give you a present for a trade." I came up on top of that one, I'll tell you. And I still got that today. Right now I'm trying to, I'm going to give it to my daughter. But I want it in a glass case. I ordered these glass domes. But every time it gets here, it comes broken. I figure I'll go to JD Glass and have them make up something. That's, I'm glad I did that for my dad. My idea of war, of Vietnam, was we had no business there. We had no business. They've been fighting that war for 30 years. The war started in the Bay of Tonkin, where a United States warship was being approached by a fishing boat or something like that. And they thought it was a gunship. So they blew that boat out of the water. And that started the Vietnam War. That got America involved in the Vietnam War. We didn't belong there. It was a big mistake. And then Kennedy died. Johnson didn't know what to do. He didn't know anything military. Good thing we had a good, smart general then. Westmoreland, the commanding general for military forces over there in Vietnam. Westmoreland was my general when I was stationed at Fort Campbell. He's a pretty good guy. He said, "You're fatigued." He said, "Do your uniform. If you feel you want to alter it or anything, then go ahead." So we did. Take it to the, you know, tapered sleeves, tapered fat legs. And when he went to Vietnam, Johnson sent him to Vietnam, we had another general come in, you know, General Ciccolelli. And he looked at you and he said, "That's not a government issue uniform." He said, you get yourself into a uniform that you're issued. So I had to toss out all our taper fatigues and about the same old stuff. Part I really hated, when all these race riots were breaking out down south, and Chicago was really bad, we went to training for race riot and riot control, and we were sent to Chicago. And we were marching against this mob, and this guy's spitting at us and cussing us out, throwing rocks, throwing beer cans. I'm marching against him and looking at him and saying, "This is crazy. He's an American. I'm an American. And we're almost in combat with each other. This is..." I didn't like that. I didn't like the idea of Americans are divided. You see, this is more evident in a friend of mine that went over to Vietnam or in a conflict, whether they're in Cambodia or Vietnam. The ones that came back, I'm happy for them. The ones that didn't come back, I miss them. Some of them grew up with hunting and fishing, small village. Do what you got to do to survive. Back in them days, that's all. We'll talk about my dad, David Williams Sr., called Sikaw. When my dad was a young man living in Juneau, his dad, John Williams, was working in a gold mine, I think the AJ Gold Mine. And the ore cart was rolling down the tunnel, and somehow or another, John Williams' legs went up on the track, and his ore carts ran over his legs, severing both of his legs off. So my dad had to quit school from the fourth grade to get a job and earn money and be a sole supporter of the house. But luckily, my dad had uncles that were knowledgeable. My dad built boats that he learned how to do from his uncle. He built a boat that we fished for years. My dad built that Amby Hall, all these houses, the war houses downtown. He built that. The White Alice site up there, he built that. But he was a carpenter, a boat builder, a musician, and a fisherman. It seemed like there was nothing that my dad couldn't do. He said that you got to do whatever it takes to put food on the table. If you're the man of the house, that's what you do. That's what he did. He raised 12 kids. There was 12 of us, 7 sisters, 4 brothers. We thought, back then, there was no social programs like welfare or food stamps or anything. He did it because he had to do it. That's the way things were. We called cohos in the fall time for the smokehouse, you know, put in a smokehouse, winter fish. I caught this huge king salmon, huge. I took it to Mike Thompson's cold storage. I took it there. And he looked at it, and he put the fish gear in it, and said, the meat in there was rainbow, red and white. He said, "I have to buy it as a white." So I thought, I'm not going to sell for a white. That time, white kings were cheaper. Now, white king is more expensive because Europe say anything with any fish with white meat in it is healthy for you, like halibut and cod, you know. And anyway, I took that boat the fish back down to my boat, tied up my boat, packed that fish home. And I got the head here, and the tail is still dragging on the ground. So I get home, and I couldn't carry it anymore, so I just dropped it on the floor. And my dad came and looked at me and said, "You should tell it, son." "Nah, I want to eat it." "No, you make some money selling it, too. But we'll get a lot of meals out of that fish." Captain Nader. Dressed out, it weighed 72 pounds. That was a big fish. My daughter caught one, 83. 83 pounds. We're down there by the harbor. He said, "Dad, I want to hold a fish over so I can take a picture." And I saw a guy come. I said, "Well, maybe I'll hold the fish up. And then I see that guy will take a picture." I called him over and he said, "Well, yeah, I said, I'll take it." So she tried to lift it up. And I said, "Why don't we hold it up together?" So I hold it up like that. She didn't have her hand on it. But when I get the picture, she's pointing it like this and got a thumb pointing at it. It got lost. Because when school started, the teacher says, "Why don't we start by telling us what you did last summer?" So they started kids in front of me. "I went to Disney World, Disneyland, did this, did that." And all kind of stuff. And my daughter, she just pulled the book, closed the book. "What did you do, Carolyn?" "Oh, nothing." "Come on, you must have done something." "Oh, and especially my dad. Catch anything?" "Yeah, got an 83 pound king." "No way, there's no fish that big. And a 250 pound halibut." "Yeah, no way." Then she opened her book and she got pictures. Everybody forgot about Disneyland and everything. I wanted to see the picture of the big fish. That was pretty cool. She loved the boat. Carolyn loved the boat. When I get up in the morning, I get up real early. I'm looking out the window. I hear she jump off the bed. I hear a person run down the hall. I said, "What are you doing, Dad?" "I thought I might go out and fish for a while." She'd run back and put all her warm clothes on and go down the boat. One time we started showing from the coal storage dock to before we got to the ferry terminal, we already had four fish, four kings. That time you were allowed to catch two apiece. So we had four fish. "You got two and I got two." And I said, "We have to go home." She said, "I don't want to go home. We have to go home. Fishing game is going to catch us and I'll go to jail. I'm going home." So I go and I'm tied up on my slip and I'm cleaning the fish. And this guy comes over and he said, "Boy, you already had your day." It was like 7 o'clock in the morning. "You already had your day." And Carolyn's washing the fish, I'm cleaning it. And he says, "Where'd you catch them?" Carolyn looked at me and I looked at her. And we both said, "Right here." That guy looked, "I hate people like you." He said, "I've been there for 4 days. I ain't caught nothing. Just go from here to there and come back with four fish."